One, and we are recording with Mr. John O'Loughlin on Tuesday, January 24th, 2023, at 4:10 p.m. Eastern Time for episode, I think it's 1068. I might have lied to you and told you it was 1070. I can't be trusted. I think I got it wrong. But yeah. So I'm still figuring out all the bugs of doing this live. So you're getting the baptism by fire with me. But Mr. O'Loughlin, please introduce yourself, my friend.
Well, hello, I'm John O'Loughlin, also known as McDuff on my YouTube channel, McDuff Lives, and glad to be with you, Tommy. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. It's very nice to meet you too. So I guess what got you into the entire, I guess, I got introduced to you by, George Webb. Is what got you into just all things research? Just curious.
Well, it's kind of like you know the story of the Odyssey with Odysseus, the great hero that goes to war, and then he has a son, and the son's name is Telemachus. And Telemachus is on a mission to find out what happened to his father. And I think that's probably the generation of this. It's probably something as natural and human as long as there's been men with sons. And so I've all my life been wondering what really happened to my dad. We of course had a basic story, but as as life unfolded, I finally got time to do a deep dive into it, and as a result of that, I was able to write this book, my book about my dad called McDuff Lives.
McDuff lives. And your dad had a relationship with Kennedy, if I'm correct.
Not directly, as far as I know. It's possible that he knew Bobby Kennedy, but it's just possible. I have no proof of that. The connection would be more indirect in that when President Kennedy decided to take the special operations away from the CIA, he created a office in the Pentagon that was called that's called SACSA, and that office was given the responsibility of running and overseeing and planning the special operations, taking it away from the CIA. And in order to do that, President Kennedy asked his brother Robert to assemble some people that would be appropriate. And I do not know the details or even whether my dad was directly recruited by Bobby Kennedy or whether it was more of a circuitous thing. But the idea was to have him be the planner of special operations for all branches of the service and all intelligence agencies under President Kennedy's new regime.
And everyone obviously knows the quote, shatter into 1,000 pieces or splinter into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the wind. But the real, I guess, oomph behind that was taking away the ability to do special operations. I guess, what made it separate from other intelligence gathering agencies was that it had the power to enact. It had teeth, it had boots on the ground. And that kind of seemed, that's the, they took away the bone from the dog, and that was no bueno in the CIA's eyes. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah, that's very correct. And you just imagine the enmity of an Allen Dulles with all the power that he had and getting fired by President Kennedy. You don't think he's going to stand for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good book. I think it's called Brothers. It might be called Brothers. I think it's by Stephen Kinzer. I could be butchering that, but it's about the Dulles brothers and their entire background. And the entire book is just painting the picture of these two behemoths in the intelligence, finance, international business world. And then Pretty Boy Kennedy comes along and just goes, "Now get out of here." And after reading that, like I had always known the Dulles brothers, but after reading that book, I read it, I think probably around this time last year. After reading that book, you get a much better a sense of foreboding where you're like, oh, that'd be like if someone had never heard of the sport of football and I wrote a story about me picking up a football and I went to the park and played with a guy named Tom Brady. You'd be like, oh, who's this Tom Brady cat? versus learning everything about Tom Brady. And then the story ends with me picking up a football and saying, I'm going to go play against Tom Brady. You would kind of have this feeling of, oh shit, you're about to get your lunch taken from you. That kind of also seems to be the case with the Dulles brothers. For the listeners and for myself, could you maybe describe in your research what you believe has happened to your father, or did happen to your father?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. Let me first chime in on your reference to a very good book is an introduction to the Dulles brothers. It's called The Dulles Brothers and Their Secret World War. So don't forget the subtitle, because they're waging war. They're using us. They're using our country, our taxpayer dollars, our facilities, our army, our navy, our air force. They're using us to wage their war, and that is the difficulty that we're facing right now. Is the use of private interests to wage war and take the ability of the American people to say no, just take it away. There's not much we can do to stop them right now. And this is all the result of what happened back then, when you had John Foster Dulles at State and Allen Dulles at CIA during the whole Eisenhower administration. So what happens to my father, of course, it's still a bit of a mystery to me. I really do think it's better, you know, told in the book than for me to try to summarize. But basically, my father was a man who, once Allen Dulles encountered him, his days were numbered.
Okay.
Because he was the man that Kennedy chose to smash the CIA. That's exactly what you, when you started the show, you hit the nail right on the head. That was the key to Allen Dulles' power, was the ability to use special operations to his benefit, but and to the benefit of his clients. Because, of course, he's an agent for the great wealth, the oil companies, the big insurance companies, all of the European money. He has the interest of all of the most wealthy people in Wall Street, who he's looking out for. He does not care a bit about the average American or whether we go to war or not. It's just a question of how does he preserve and increase the wealth of his clients. And that is a sign of the times. The sadness that we're encountering right now is that everything is reduced to dollars and cents, and everybody's life is, you know, they're even shortening the life expectancy. Our health is being taken away from us. And everything that my father fought for in World War II, everything that the greatest generation stands for, is now being swept away in the interest of this behemoth of financial and old elite wealth. So my dad was there at Saxa from 1962, which was right after the Bay of Pigs, and then from 1962 until he died in 1971. He died on June the 6th, 1971, of cancer, and it's what I would refer to as fast cancer. The circumstances of it are highly suspicious. The details are complex, and it would be hard for me to go into them all right now, and the proof is not completely there yet, so I'm still patching up some holes as we study, you know, the medicine, the things that were going on back then, because I think the other aspect of it that's important for folks to know is that immediately when he was accepted to the job at Saxa, he became infected with hepatitis. And the circumstances of it are so suspicious that I've started looking into the virus vaccine game, just as we do today with COVID. Well, look at hepatitis B as something that they were working on in a similar way back in the 50s and early 60s. I've had a great benefit from a man named Nick at on Twitter. He doesn't give his full name, but it's Nick from Twitter, if you're familiar with him. He's been very good to help me understand that aspect of it. So while I think it's more than possible, I think it's likely that my father was given a dose of this hepatitis B in order to weaken him, possibly to kill him, as he was placed in that office to take over the responsibilities of special operations for all the branches of government. So anyway, he lasted until 1971, his death being on June the 6th is a little bit eerie and resonates. Yeah, and resonates with a lot of other kind of funny coincidences that you find in his life and in other people's lives. So it just requires me to delve into all kinds of different things, from the virus vaccine and bioweapons scenario to the politics of it, and what was going on in the Pentagon, in, as well as what was going on in the CIA, because just because they're against the CIA doesn't mean that they're good guys either. No. You also have lots of people with different competing interests. And so, yeah, I've dug into it now for about the past 4 or 5 years, doing one show a day generally, and really, really feeling good about it. I think we're making a lot of progress.
I'll make sure to put the link to your book in the description, and I'll grab it and read it. And I would love to have you on specifically to talk about that. I'll do my due diligence. That is one thing I pride myself on, is if I get an author, I will read their book and I will do an episode with them about that. But yeah, it kind of a damned position though, right? Kennedy is. Yeah. He's writing the check of I'm going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces, but he's making your dad cash it. And like, that's between a rock and a hard place, right? You're doing the obviously they whacked Kennedy, but I mean, they're going to take out anyone involved with removing the teeth. And that's what special operations was. It's hidden behind the veil of the flag of national security, of classifications, of need to know. And like all things humans do, it's immediately infected and tampered by the least among us, who they take this dark, shadowy intelligence agent. I mean, right, it was a month after Kennedy was whacked that Truman came out and said, I think a month to the day, so December 22nd, 1963. Yes, December 22nd, 1963, Truman came out and said, I never thought the CIA would have been used for cloak and dagger operations during peacetime. I think we need to reevaluate it. And that's the guy that brought it to life. Instantly, this thing is just immediately co-opted by financial interests, not just the military-industrial complex, but I mean, like you said, oil, pharma, insurance, finance, media. They take this thing that is, it's like an invisibility cloak. If you had this invisibility cloak to go fight crime, how long until someone uses it to start robbing banks? And it's like, yeah, it's not to be pessimistic, but it's almost something you need to factor in with man, capital M, is that any power, it's the double-edged sword. It's okay, you can use it to put butter on bread. You can also use it to kill your mom. We do have a tendency throughout human history to take anything with great power, with any sort of information asymmetry, and immediately use it to our own ends, often through nefarious processes. And that's immediate. And that's what, just 15 years after its 15 or 16 years after its inception. Yeah, no, CIA was 47. So 16 years after its inception, and it's already being used for these things. And now your dad's tasked with taking away the endless gift.
Yeah, that puts it very well. And then, you know, to continue from there, the war between these two factions, the CIA supporters and the CIA opponents, is expressed in this book by Douglas Valentine.
I've interviewed Mr. Valentine several times.
Well, then, you know, he's one of the great experts on the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. on the Phoenix drug program, trade, so many aspects of what happened during my dad's life. And It so happens that in 1980, I think it was, he published this book called TDY. And it was a story based upon true events in which he changed the names and just used cover names for people he didn't know.
Sure.
And the character that, well, that sends out this mission, the mission is to photograph and videotape a drug deal that they knew was going to happen between the CIA and the Vang Pao drug army in Laos in 1967. So the secret mission is going out under Pentagon auspices to catch the CIA. This is a
wow.
mission which has never been talked about. It's in this book. And the mission, the person that sends them out on the mission, he calls Mr. Hammer. Why does he call him Mr. Hammer? Because Mr. Hammer, the guy that Doug Valentine was describing, was a big bull-necked man wearing what he called a gabardine, which is one of those olive or drab suits that military people will wear when they're
gotcha.
civilian.
Yeah, like an Eisenhower.
And just a
McCarthy.
Really, really tough talking guy. Well, you know, my dad had a bull neck. My dad was a very tough guy. I mean, he was tough, you know. He was almost 6'4" and 240 and was a football player at Harvard.
Oh, good
so,
Lord.
So he was monster, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to the most people of his generation, he was absolutely huge.
Yeah.
And anyway, so my dad is, Doug and I talked about it. We talked about it over and over. It is absolutely certain that my dad was Mr. Hammer.
Mr. Hammer.
So he's the guy that not only, you know, after Kennedy's killed, keeps the mission alive. You know, he obviously has allies that I don't know who they are, but he's there in Saxo working with generals and colonels. And they set that mission out. Now, the mission, if it had succeeded, world history would be different.
Yeah.
So, you know, the answer, the end of the book is not going to be a happy ending. But the story, that the fact that it happened at all
is.
And then the fact that, what, 30, 40 years later, the author Doug Valentine and I have gotten together on a different, entirely different reason. And we, at the same time, in the middle of one of my videos, we realize that's my dad in Doug's book. We both realize it at the same time.
That's wild. I've had the honor of interviewing him. He's been on here, I think, twice to cover his book, Phoenix Program, the CIA's use of terror in Vietnam, and then I think the CIA's organized crime. So he doesn't hold back on his accusations. And they're factual.
And I have read the entire Phoenix Program on my show, as I have The Brothers by Stephen Kinzer, by the way. And while we're on the subject, on Mondays at 11 a.m. Eastern time on my show, I'm currently reading A Law Unto Itself, The Untold Story of the Law Firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, which is all about how Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles first came up.
Yeah,
how they got started through the law firm on Wall Street that ended up representing, you know, from everybody from the Rockefellers to the Nazis.
Yeah, they're another one of their Brown Brothers, Harriman. They love the big movie. I always have this imagery of sorry to interrupt, of like moving targets at like a shooting range, and they're just kind of, you know, they're on like running tracks and they're going left and right. And they have them going back 10, 20, 30, 50 meters. I always have this imagery of us, the observer, the civilian, just watching. And these are the moving targets, are the fronts. It's Brown Brothers Harriman. It's Cromwell. It's the CIA. It's the World Bank. And then you have people jumping behind the targets. And that would be your Dulles brothers. And it's, you never know. You're just watching. You're like, what are you talking about? It's just moving targets. And it's, they love to move behind these secretive, you know, their best case scenario is CIA. You just cloak yourself in the flag and say it's classified. But if you can't do that, you move behind these other front companies. And that's how they, and if you've never broached any of these topics, it seems fantastical. But that's exactly what they did, is they just dance behind these dare I say, shell companies, but at the very least, just facades. Sorry to interrupt about that, but that's what they do.
Well, that's right, and they have this philosophy that that they are the ones that should be in charge because they're the smartest people. They're the ones with the breeding, with the that elite education, and plus they all belong to the same clubs. So, you know, and then you can bring from there to clubs to go to Skull and Bones is not a big leap at all. So
wow.
There you have
Locking Key.
There you have the enemy, as President Kennedy said so well in his in I think it was the American University speech, when he's, you know, he spoke about secret societies, mm-hmm. and how the very word secrecy is repugnant.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in an open and free society. Yeah, guerrillas exactly. by night instead of matching armies by day. Yeah, and it's been his Boston twang. Yeah,
not bad, not bad at all.
Thank you. Maybe I have. If the podcast doesn't work out, maybe I'll go into in person. I'm also a white Irish guy. I could maybe pull off a Ken. I'm Thomas Patrick Kerrigan. I could maybe pull off a John Fitzgerald Kennedy. But that is I had never even heard of that operation. The fact that that happened at all is mind-boggling. That the Pentagon went out to almost put the CIA in a sting. I mean, that's Shakespearean.
It is
the truly like the Game of Thrones. It is the highest they're not a monolith. They really are out of, and like you said, it also doesn't mean that they're the good guys. It just if two demons are vying for the throne of hell, just because one demon's trying to unseat the other doesn't mean they're on your side. They're still demons.
Well, that, of course, you know, some demons are better than other demons.
Sure.
And that, you know, always reminds me of that wry joke in Master and Commander, the Patrick O'Brien movie, where Captain Jack Aubrey, you know, he says to Stephen, you know, the non-sailor guy, he's got two little weevils fall out of his biscuit. He taps them on, and because they fall out, and he's, now Stephen, which of these weevils would you choose if you had to choose? And he goes over it over and over again. He says, "Well, I'll take the longer one. It looks like he's probably stronger and could probably, you know, manage better. And so I'll pick the long one." And Captain Aubrey says, "Wrong." He says, "In the British Navy, one must always choose the lesser of two weevils." and that's what I think we're in. We're in the British Navy now because we don't get choices. You can choose this weevil or that weevil, but you can't choose good. That's not one of the choices. And so I have to say, right now in politics in America, it's not about who you like. It's about who you like, who you least are afraid of, who you least are concerned about. And that was the case all along. That to me, the military side of it generally is the patriotic side. And the CIA side of it is the anti-sovereignty side, the side that says, we're going to break down the national boundaries. Fletcher Prouty's work on that, the secret team, is essential as far as how that all was going. It started right after World War II. And this part of our intelligence, military intelligence complex, is actively working against sovereignty. You notice it, for instance, NATO taking over the naval base in Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
Our military becoming part of a bigger thing, this NATO thing, which doesn't respond to the U.S. Congress, doesn't follow the Constitution necessarily, and is becoming, you know, the army for this, what I would call openly fascist totalitarian state that they're trying to impose. So that's the choice. I would much rather have the people that believe in the Constitution, believe in the Declaration of Independence. And we can acknowledge that a lot of them in the past, and maybe even at the present, were racist. that's part of the culture. We're, a lot of people grew up in a time when it was natural to be concerned about another race, that that your grandparents, your parents would tell you, you know, don't go out with those people of that other color there. You'll have a terrible life. You'll be poor. Your children will never get go anywhere. And, you know, for other reasons, because they were ignorant. The fact is that up until more recent times, most people were afraid of the stranger, were afraid of people that didn't look like them. And it was easy for the financial and other powers to control people by encouraging that fear, encouraging that separation. And then, of course, that then grows into the Hegelian dialectic. And here we are in this big time with, you know, the right and the left and the right and the left and back and forth and back and forth. And as you say, the people behind the curtain are the ones that are manipulating, shading it this way or that way to benefit their own interests.
It does seem like, though, to I guess shift gears to an optimistic viewpoint or vantage point, is that as we do progress forward in society, right? And because it's, you can't stick your head in it, like you said, you can't stick your head in the sand and pretend that like the vast majority of this, the history of this country, wasn't racist. It just was. And to deny that is downright stupid. That being said, as we do, even just turn the clocks back, what, 100? When could women vote? Was it 1919? And, or was it afterwards? I mean, let's just say 105 years. I mean, even like women couldn't vote. And that's 40, 50 years before the civil rights movement. As we progress forward, though, societally, it seems like, and again, this is an optimistic viewpoint, perhaps naive, it seems like we're removing some of the tools of the divide and conquer, the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, Hegelian dialectic, problem, reaction, solution. They thrive off division and conquer. As we move forward, and when we don't have segregation or we have less institutionalized racism, is that grounds to be optimistic that we're almost like Kennedy? We're kind of pulling out the teeth of the beast, or are they just growing new ones as we take away old ones? Not that you have the answer, but.
Well, if you compare us to 100 years ago, it's hard not to be optimistic.
Sure.
And look, as you said, you know, and even in just, if you look in the case of women, half of the country. Right. And yeah. I just read this morning on my show or yesterday in A Law Unto Itself that at Sullivan and Cromwell in 1920, same time you're talking about, they took the bold step of hiring some female associates. And these are young women lawyers that went to work at Sullivan and Cromwell with the knowledge and the certainty that they would never, ever, ever be partners. Now, can you imagine starting out a legal career at the most prestigious law firm in the country and knowing, you know, just because you're a woman, that you will never make partner? And that, to me, is just horrible. But that's the way it was, because everything was sexist. And everything is becoming less sexist and, you know, perhaps in some cases going too far in the other direction. But I'm very hopeful that in terms of many of these old ancient prejudices, that they will fall away. Look what happens to people that hold on to those prejudices. They get into wars. Look at Ukraine. Ukraine, to me, is an extension of World War II. You have one side kind of favoring the Western European and the NATO and the kind of a more Catholic religion, and then the other side favors the Soviet Union, the more Orthodox religion, and or perhaps just everybody's pretty much neutral in many cases. But the division between the people of Ukraine is better than any gold mine to the financial powers behind this war. And as long as they keep that war going, man, they're going to keep on making money. And and the people that believe in hate, the ones that just hate the Russians because your father and your grandfather and your great grandfather hated the Russians and because of what they did, and I'm sure they did it. And then the people that hate the Ukrainians and call them Nazis and all that, and they're absolutely right too, because the Nazis really were, and the Ukrainians, a lot of them were collaborationists doing some of the most horrible things. But that's 80 years ago. How long will it take for people to realize that that hate gets turned into death? That hate gets turned into just exploitation. And when this is over, who's going to own it? BlackRock, Vanguard, the great financial powers are buying the whole place up. That beautiful black soil, the breadbasket of the world. And as other people have pointed out, it's also the crossroads of an awful lot of important transportation and oil pipelines. So that central area there is exactly what the Hegelian dialectic does for the empire. It just allows them to let these two fight it out and then come in and pick up the pieces. The Phoenix rises.
We weren't 6 months out of Kabul before we've got a new thing. I mean, it seems to give, and who knows, maybe I'm just generalizing everyone, but it seems to give no one pause that, like, the permanent war economy, it just, we drop it for 6 months. I mean, we were, what, Cold War was over, we went a decade, and we, well, actually, we went a couple years and we went over to Iraq, and then we waited for about 8 more years and went back to Afghanistan and Iraq. We're withdrawn from Kabul. We don't even last a year. What was that? When was that? August. So August of 2022. So what, September, October, November, December, or of 2021. So yeah, August, September, October, November, December, January, February. We go 7 months and then we're back in Ukraine. The machine keeps rolling forward. And I always think about the historian, Dan Carlin. He's got the series Hardcore History. Absolutely fantastic. He does these like series of podcasts that take him like a year to produce 5 episodes, but they're better than any audiobook you'll ever listen to. And he's done like, Genghis Khan. He's done Alexander the Great. The only one I've listened to is Blueprints for Armageddon. It's about World War I. And it's like 6 parts, 4 hours each. Most incredible, better than any audiobook I've ever listened to. It is the most riveting thing you can listen to. And but he had this quote about how he was brought in to talk at like the Pentagon or something in like 03 for the invasion of Iraq. I guess they wanted like historical, I guess, guidance. And he later said he thinks it was just so they could check the box and say, look, we brought in a historian, they were going to do whatever. But the point of all this is, he goes, the first half of the meeting is that they're talking about, what we're gonna, at this point, it's on the news. Everyone, it's not like it's classified. We're going to go into Iraq. We're going to take Saddam. And he goes, but then the second 50% of the meeting, you saw the military industrial complex. It then came down to, where are we getting the armor? Where are we getting the tanks? Where are we getting the fuel lines? How are we going to provide these things to our allies? And how are we going to provide the replacement parts and, make sure not to give them everything because then they won't need us. And you saw the real iron, the actual meat on the bones of the military industrial complex. And I've been thinking about that quote now when we see kind of all the propaganda, Russia's evil, Slava Ukraine, or Ukraine's Nazis, Russia's, NATO, and blah, 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 blah. And then you just see that, you just see the moment where the kaleidoscope aligns and the image just condenses for just a second. And it's just a headline. Zelensky meets with BlackRock about reconstruction of Ukraine. There it is. You see the thing, and then whoo, it's just as gone. Then we're right back into the news. Kanye West said this. But you, every once in a while, you see like, you just see like the black cloven foot of the military industrial it sneaks out from behind the curtain, and very quickly they pull it back in. But you can just see it. There's just these moments of where it just crystallizes, and it's, I don't know. I don't, it, is there anything other to do than I mean, is the answer as easy as just stop hating one another? Because you're right, someone's always going to take advantage of that hate. Someone's always going to, no different than a windmill capturing wind or a solar panel capturing the sun. Someone's always going to use that waste heat energy of hate. Someone's going to use that, no different than a surfer catching a wave or a geothermal power plant capturing the heat of tectonic plates shifting. Whenever there is hate, which, and if they can, stoke it and make it bigger, they'll do so. There is something to capture. No different than the Titanic going across the ocean because people are shoveling coals into the engines. Someone will always take advantage of that. And so long as there's someone with a slightly different skin color or just a moderately different faction of Christianity, somebody's licking their chops. And I don't know. I don't really know where I'm going with this whole rant.
Well, you do hear people, European politicians, speaking about Slavs as different from us. They're different from us. You Slavs have a different mentality. Well, do you remember? Used to be the Germans. Germans have different mentality. They have this war thing inside them. They can't not be at war. That was the German thing. Now we've got the Slav thing, and it's all psychological warfare against people, against everybody, not just against the enemy. It's like things like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. They're broadcasting a bunch of pro-American propaganda at the Eastern countries, but what they're really doing is reinforcing the Western countries' population as being against, the Eastern people, the commies. They have shadows that walk around behind them and keep track of them, and it's totalitarian nightmare, and you can't get a decent loaf of bread. And that's part of it too, the propaganda on us to keep us thinking of them as different and dangerous, and we don't want to go there. But what I am really concerned about now, of course, is, does this military industrial complex have any, is there any way to stop it, or are they going to push this into a big war with Russia? They sure are sounding like they have no intention of stopping. They're going to Moscow just like Napoleon and Hitler. Let's on to Moscow, it seems to be the cry from our leadership. And the Europeans are being pulled into it. They're sending more and more tanks, and who knows whether this is going to get big or not, but I don't see it stopping. That's the problem. What's your opinion? Do you think we're heading towards a major conflict with Russia right now?
Again, to quote Dan Carlin, he talks about, and he's not someone I normally quote. I don't know why I'm bringing him up now, but there is this part of Blueprints for Armageddon where he's talking about these generals. He's actually talking about Kennedy, and Kennedy is talking about World War One. And he's quoting how these generals afterwards were talking to each other. They might have been from different sides. I don't know, like Germany and Britain. And they're having a glass of whatever with it, drinking whiskey, smoking cigars. And one of them asks the other, "How did it all begin?" And the other looks at him and says, "Ah, if only we knew." Because if the more you learn about World War One, the more you learn it was just this system of safeguards. And there's this great quote, and it's like no one was actually fight there to fight. Everyone was fighting because someone else was fighting. And it's everyone was kind of, well, I'm just going because he's going. It was just all these Bismarckian just treaties just going together, and the machine work started. And then Kennedy says, and he's talking about it during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He goes, "I don't want some like something along the lines of I don't want some like survivors to be in a nuclear bunker 50 years from now and in an irradiated Earth, looking back and going, how did it all start?" And the other goes, "If only we knew." And so, when I look at where we are now, I see the same naivety. You'll see headlines like, "There couldn't be another world war. The world's too interlocked." That is like verbatim what headlines were running in 1914. We are too civilized of a society. We are too mechanized. They had Model Ts and biplanes. We now think that we are too mechanized and too interdependent to go into a world war. So, whereas my gut says no, cooler heads will prevail, you're kind of hitting the nail on the head. Like, all right, do you see how it's going to slow down? No part of me rationally sees this slowing down. It's like an 18-wheeler coming down an icy hill. And we're like, well, it could apply the brakes at any time. And it's like, I don't know if the brakes are going to work, man. Like, we have this time, this distance between us and the 18-wheeler. And we have this illusion that the brakes might work. But what happens when they hit the brakes and nothing happens? Then you just have a few fleeting moments of terror. So, again, I'm 32 with a biology degree, so I'm not sure how, you know, weighted my geopolitical opinion should be. But on one hand, I don't see us, because it seems like a suicide pact for the planet of just thermonuclear holocaust. On the other hand, I don't see it stopping. I just think it's going to... We have an unstoppable object with an immovable object and an unstoppable force. The Russians aren't going to back down from what they perceive to be a threat of their sovereignty and an encroachment of NATO and a bunch of Nazis. And we're not going to back down from backing the good guys against the evil Russian bear. And we're kind of powerless. And then we don't even know what are the real machinations behind it. In 100 years, there'll be some great books written about it. Like you and I are talking about the Dulles brothers and, you know, Cromwell and Brown Brothers Harriman. And we don't even know who we think we know. We think it's the World Economic Forum. We think it's Davos. We think it's Vanguard. We think it's BlackRock. But that's what we know. So if you and I know it, then that's not even what the real thing is. There's something behind it. So I don't know. In short, my answer is I don't see it happening, but I can't rationally see why anything else would happen. So I think we're going towards it. I think it's like an inability of my mind to comprehend what we're going towards. Because if you walk it out, you'd say, yeah, so we're heading towards thermonuclear holocaust. It's dividing by zero. The screen just turns into static. It's like, wait, what? You know, you can kind of fathom after 9/11, we're going to war. You have an image of your mind, we're going to invade, and there's tanks and explosions and soldiers coming home in coffins. Like, you can kind of conceptualize it, as evil as it is, you can understand it. But there's this weird, like, event horizon. We're going over a waterfall. And it's, yeah, we're just heading towards thermonuclear holocaust. What? Like, that's Old Testament, New Testament. It's a... No pun intended, but it is just a blinding white light of, I guess I can't wrap my head around it, because I imagine I won't be here to grasp it. I'll be vaporized. So I don't know.
It's the toughest subject that we have to face, but we have to face it. And sure. I would just, you know, give you my feedback or opinion as to what you just said. First of all, I think you're right that it is going to keep going. I disagree that it's going to go thermonuclear. I don't think that's going to happen.
I hope you're right.
I don't think so. I think that, you know, that way it just can keep on going, you know. Thermonuclear is, it's over.
Game's over.
When the game's over, okay? They don't want the game to be over.
No.
So but this is something that they can scare everybody with. You know, so it keeps us all like, oh, yeah, well, we better send another 100 tanks over to Ukraine, or else we'll, get blown up by the Ruskies, right? You know, it's crazy logic, but it works because people are easily scared. And the thermonuclear mutual assured destruction doctrine has been as much of a psychological warfare against the American people as anything else, because there wasn't really that great of a danger of us getting outbuilt in missile technology, or we always had more than the Russians did. The CIA lied about it for decades in order to get us oriented towards nuclear weapons and spend all of our defense dollars in that direction, as opposed to real defense, like paying soldiers, for instance. So that, you know, was the 50s. That was the Eisenhower plan, was the next world war is going to be a non-traditional war. And that's what we're in now. We're in non-traditional warfare. The goal is complete domination of the earth.
Yeah.
This has been the goal all along.
Since dawn of time. Yeah.
All empires have the goal of the complete domination of the earth. And, you know, you look at people like the portraits of the popes in the Middle Ages, and they're holding on to a little globe.
Yeah, a gold globe with the cross on it.
Right, right. They're saying, you know, this is mine. You know,
yeah.
You got everything. It's all mine. And they, you know, religiously believe it. But more importantly, the old families believe it. The old Italian fundi, the old German bloodlines, the old the ones that ended up in England, and all of these people, they believe that they're entitled as well, entitled to rule, and that the idea of democracy is one of the worst ideas that's ever been thought up. That they are completely convinced that people will just screw everything up if you turn it over to them. Kind of a of an elitist attitude that it seems to be inalienable. They can't get rid of it. They're always going to think of themselves as being wiser, smarter, and more clever than anybody else, and entitled to exploit because of that. And you know, everything becomes a matter of power and who can grab the most. And that's the imperial way, and that's why the United States was founded, is my opinion, is to fight against that, to give everybody a chance to actually be free of that totalitarian state that owns your body. You know, that's the thing that people forget, you know, in a totalitarian state like Mussolini's Italy or Russia or you know, Nazi Germany or a lot of places. The state owns you. You know, your body is not yours. You can't say no to whatever they want to do in those circumstances. And now we've got a taste of that here with the laws surrounding pandemics and epidemics that have been foisted upon us in the last 15 to 20 years. These new laws are substantial differences from ancient, from traditional American medical and public health policy, and turning all this over to a huge institution like the Department of Health, Homeland Security is completely against the principles of the founding fathers that would have put health primarily in your hands, secondarily in your town or country or community's hands in case of hearing of contagious disease or epidemics that, you know, the town crier, the town marshal or the sheriff or the county judge or somebody could say, we're not going to let you leave your house until 2 weeks have gone by because you're sick. And that kind of local control was the way it was for the first 50, 60 years until the Civil War. And in the late 19th century, the big institutions finally got the Supreme Court on their side and started making everything a huge federal law and taking away local control. So now we've lost our local control over our own health. And that is, I think, one of the biggest problems we have right now. I think it's completely unconstitutional, and we need to get some laws passed that restore bodily integrity to each of us.
And the defenders of this overstepping of federal power will always say, well, it's an extraordinary circumstance. Yeah, the people perpetuating this aren't stupid. They might be evil, but they're not stupid. Yeah, it's always going to be for your health. It's always going to be in your... They're never going to come out and say, hey, we're just going to do dragnet surveillance on all 350 million of y'all. They're going to pass the bill when the rubble is still smoldering in lower Manhattan. It's not a coincidence, right?
Yeah.
You not having control over your body and needing mandates and digital IDs to access, you know, workplaces and sports venues and concerts. That's not by mistake that it's in the wake of a severely deadly disease. Like, there's a reason for that, because back to what you said about thermonuclear war, they don't want to, I always say this, they want to run the table. They don't want to flip the table. They want to run the casino, but they don't want to burn it down, because then the game's over. They still want to play the game. They still like yachts. They still like private planes. They still like, you know, high-end call girls. But they will use it as a threat. And as you know, more people, I would imagine, get hip to the idea that they're never going to let it go thermonuclear, then they have to develop other teeth to fight you. And it's pandemics. It's your old, it's almost like a sequel. It's almost bad Hollywood writing. We're just back to Nazis versus Russians. There's no innovation. It's just, we're really just doing a throwback to World War II with this. But they're going to keep beating those drums. And I imagine the next thing will be some form of cyber 9/11 or cyber Pearl Harbor. That'll be the next way to really, you know, clamp down on speech. But it will go, but really at its core, if you boiled it down, you know, like you can boil really like all of physics down to just equal and opposite reactions, right? It manifests itself in a trillion different ways from galaxies to atoms, but it's at its core, it's that, right? Energy can either be created nor destroyed, and matter can either be created nor destroyed. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and time is primarily defined by the flow of heat. Like you, with that, you can kind of simulate the whole universe. At its core, everything they do just comes down to utilizing your hatred and or fear to then limit your very freedoms, all the while thinking you're receiving safety. And almost, it seems like that mindset and us hopefully one day evolving out of it will be on par with the opposable thumb or written language. Like it'll be a new world. I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime, probably not. But like, I can't imagine. And it's almost that event horizon of like, what would happen if we just stopped hating each other? And that's it's a very idyllic thing for me to say. I've never gone hungry. I'm in a safe apartment in the United States. Like, yeah.
Well, if I may, yeah. You sound like Martin Luther King. You know, I have been to the mountaintop. I have seen the promised land. And I think many of us that have the hope can hang on to that vision and go along with Martin, you know, and we will walk hand in hand. And one day we will all be the same, which we are. We just don't see it yet. The idea of overcoming racism, well, I think overcoming racism is part of the journey that we are still on, but I think it is a journey that we're headed in the right direction. And I think that in terms of, if I had to make a choice again, like my father did, about, am I going to support the military that wants to take this CIA down, or am I going to support the CIA that wants to take the country down? I have an easy, easy choice.
Yeah.
And between sovereignty and the United Nations ruling my life, I'll take sovereignty every time. So that's where we're at. We are now on the cusp of losing our sovereignty. We're very close to it. In many respects, we've lost it, but we haven't lost the power to get it back. We have the framework, we have the Constitution, we have the institutions that were built for us to preserve our freedom. And now it's our duty to get up, stand up, don't give up your rights, as Bob Marley says. We all really are the same. It is one love. One love is, there's only one love. You know, you can participate in it or you can exclude yourself on the basis of hate or whatever you want. But to think that life is nothing but a bunch of digits of, you know, how much is this worth? You know, how much can I get for that? And how do I get this from somebody else? You know, how do I get my oil out from under their sand, which was, you know, the big question of the Bush era. And now we're looking at nuclear power as the coming great source of power. And honestly, that should be basically free. At this point, there's no point in us continuing to buy things that should be free. Hopefully, people are going to get self-sufficient in food. My family, we're trying to head in that direction. People have got to take up independence, and then we've got to reinvigorate our communities that have been so devastated by COVID. We've got to reinvigorate our local clubs and the things that we do together and go out and ride bikes together or do, you know, go bowling, do something to do something with your neighbors. Have parties, get back together, because that is the glue that keeps us together. It's not, you know, a bunch of laws or congressmen that keep us together. It is our faith and our belief in each other. And that doesn't have to mean that we hate other people. No. We can be self-sufficient, and the idea of scarcity is no longer necessary for things to be scarce in this world. We have technological solutions to just about everything. And, you know, other than the willingness, people around the world would all have an opportunity to be content and happy and not feel like they, you know, not have to send their little child down to the village pump to get some water that might very well have malaria or dysentery in it and try to survive for another day, which happens all over the world right now. And these tragedies are not in any way necessary. That is all a result of us still allowing these powerful elite forces to exercise just inhuman control over the resources of this planet. I think there's a lot of hope that people are seeing it. The more research I do, the more obvious it is to me, and hopefully the more confidently I can share my message, which is there's no need for this. We don't need to have war. We don't need to have scarcity. There's plenty of room for everybody. This planet is huge. Very, very, very much of it has not been used at all. And, you know, the idea of us paying taxes for somebody to go out and build these incredibly expensive war machines to go out and take the last little bit of something from somebody, some farmer in Ukraine. How crazy are we going to let this go? Yeah. And we're starting to see it. You and I, we see it. We agree that we're heading in the wrong direction. But on the other hand, just shine a light on it. That's what a republic is, by the way. A republic is a public thing. It's something that has transparent government. These secret societies, these secret operations, these secret teams, the plausible deniability, all of that smoke and mirrors crap is costing us trillions of dollars, and we don't need it at all. What we need, vitamin D, vitamin C, eat your vegetables, get some exercise every day, and help keep your community air, water, and environment clean and healthy, and take care of each other. That's my message.
It really it is kind of, part of it is funny in that the elites of the, like you said, there's like, they're never willing to negotiate on the idea that the average person won't just mess it all up. But right. It's a total projection, because they're the ones that want to run around in these cloak and dagger operations and assassinate and bomb and swindle the vast, vast majority of people. Just kind of want to take it easy. Like, you know, and there's like a 0.001% group of people who are just these like hyper aggressive psychopaths, and they're projecting that on the rest of us. They're like, we they're all gonna mess it up. And it's like, the vast majority of people kind of do have just like a Bob Marley mindset. Sure, there's some variation, I understand that's a generalization, but like it doesn't have to be this way. But I always think of that. Was it Charlie Chaplin in the speech, where it's like the Great Dictator? Whatever. Mm-hmm. It is a movie, but I never watched it. But I have heard like the famous speech from it. And there's one line from it, and he said like, he was like, "Despair not." I'm gonna butcher it, but he was like, "Despair not, for the current era of kings and fascism is but a passing phase in the history of man." And when I first heard that in like 2012, I was like, that's so delusionally optimistic. And it's only been 11 years. And again, I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime, but I do revisit that quote from time to time. And it's like, despair not, this is but a passing phase. And I think about it more in terms of like, yeah, knights in armor and like feudal fiefdoms, like that was a passing phase, as was the Bronze Age. as was the slave trade, as was on and on and on, as was, you know, kings with divine right, as was pharaohs as living gods. I think this is but a passing phase. Now, it's been going on for a while, and it's probably going to keep going for a while. These phases do take a while. But I think at the end of the line, we will get to a much more perfect world, based on not even my own optimism, but just based on history. It does, despite all of the wars and the death machines, it does keep getting better. I mean, like we said, just go back 100 years. Unrecognizable socially. Despite World War I and World War II and Korea and Vietnam and on and on and on. I think it will get better. So I am in agreement with O'Loughlin 2024. Vitamin D and clean air. That I'll get behind your platform.
Yeah, and study the history. You know, this is why I think, you know, I have done this. I've written this book and talk and do this show about my dad, because I think what happened to my dad is what they're doing to the country.
Yeah.
And to use us and then throw us away is their plan. It's what they've done throughout history. And we do have a duty to recognize it and to stop it when we can. And when we see it, to say something, to talk about it with people. And that's why I think, you know, that's why I have my show. And I hope that's why so many hundreds of really good people are popping up now on various channels, Rumble. And, you know, even though I still on YouTube, I have had my battles with YouTube and wish I didn't have to be there, but it's the biggest reach that I know of. So I'm still there, but I'm opening up, Rumble, hopefully this week, and also Odyssey. So we're going to keep spreading the word and archiving our material and, you know, networking with people as we always do.
I mean, yeah, definitely. I've been banned from YouTube for like a year and a half now. But yeah, no, get on Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey, Spotify, CloudHub, Brighteon. There's a whole swath of them you can get out there. I applaud your continuing fight on YouTube. They iced me. They didn't want anything to do with me. I had no trial, straight to the guillotine. And it's actually worked out better.
You're glad. It's good that you got out early. I mean, I had over 12, I had 12,000 subscribers when they killed my channel. And, you know, so I'm back to 7,500 on my biggest channel. That's just what they do. I'd easily have 100,000 if I hadn't gotten chopped off back about, what was it, 2.5 years ago now. Anyway, things are looking good and I'm feeling good about it. And just keep spreading the word, Tommy. There is truth. There is honor. There is reality. The Constitution is a real thing that we can rely upon. The Declaration of Independence did state a new approach toward life, a life based upon human rights, on the idea that government has its legitimacy through the people and not through God and not through some king or divine right or imperial succession. It is us, we the people, that have made the difference. And that is the difference that we have to keep on making and insist that we stay in charge. We run the government. And we have to have transparency in that government and restore the honor that we should have, that our founding fathers, you know, this was a period of very serious, you know, dueling, personal honor, truth, honesty. That was very, very important back then. Compare that to a Biden today. And I don't think that he stands the test. We got to get back to those principles of honesty, truth, and freedom. And that's what our show is about. Thank you very much, Tommy.
Well, thank you for coming on here. And Mr. O'Loughlin, 2024, he's running for president. And if he doesn't want to, I'm going to submit his name against his will. But thank you for coming on here, sir. I will text you the episode when it's when the link is up. And I would love to get you on here for your book, McDuff Lives.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. Macduff Lives: The Life and Untimely Death of Thomas F. O'Loughlin Jr. And that'll be fun. I look forward to it.
I would love to. So I'll text you right after this and we'll get that in the books. And thank you so much, sir. I will put your YouTube channel, if you could text that to me, I'll put that in the description as well as the link to your book. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on here. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience with my rambling. And I look forward to the next one, man.
All right. All the best.
Thank you so much.